apocalyptic talk is very much around at the moment. Climate change, COVID, the collapse of civilization. Choose your catastrophe. Irish writer Mark O'Connell has a gloomy and nervous disposition. He's anxious about the future, especially since he became a father. So he set out to meet people preparing for doomsday. His book, Notes from an Apocalypse, deals with the serious issue of surviving Armageddon, but it's also pretty funny. It's subtitled A Personal Journey to the End of the World and Back, and Mark O'Connell is with me now from Dublin, I think. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Kim. How are you?
I'm good. Good that you got out before COVID.
Yeah, well, I haven't, you know, I got the book out before COVID, I suppose. Yeah, it's a strange time to release a book, for sure, for various reasons. A lot of dramatic irony around the release.
I wonder if you could tell me a little bit more about what prompted you to do this in the context of becoming a father.
Yeah, I mean, the book, as you say, you know, I do have a slightly anxious, I hope not too gloomy, but certainly I'm prone to sort of pessimistic kind of flights, I suppose. And when I started sort of thinking about the topics sort of surrounding this book, my son was about 3 years old at the time. And I guess I was just sort of, you know, becoming quite preoccupied with the tension between really two things, my own kind of sense of the importance as a parent of creating in my son a sense of the world as a good place and a positive place, and, you know, the future as a realm of possibility and brightness, and a tension between that on one hand, and on the other, you know, just looking at the news and, you know, checking my Twitter feed or whatever, and just seeing, you know, a real sense of the darkness of the future, and the world is, you know, not necessarily a particularly hopeful place to be bringing up young children. So the book really arose out of that kind of tension. And out of that, I became very interested in things like, you know, doomsday preppers preparing for the end of the world in various kinds of ways and at various levels. So that's really where the book sort of originated.
Did you kind of solve that cognitive dissonance then between your knowledge that we're probably all going to hell in a handcart and your need to make your children think that the world is a beautiful and hopeful place?
Well, I'm not sure that I solved it. It's kind of, you know, it's an ongoing sort of
existential crisis.
Exactly. Yes. Well, yes, exactly. And I suppose I've learned to live with the crisis a little bit. But, you know, the book definitely began out of a moment of real crisis and something like despair, I think. You know, I started writing it in, I guess, the summer of 2016. And there was a lot of kind of pretty grim stuff happening at that point. You know, the Brexit vote had happened over here. And, you know, the Trump election was just kind of on the cusp. You know, climate change was everywhere. And it all seemed to me to be kind of coalescing into a very kind of dark place. And you know, I was very anxious about it all as a parent and just as a person. I think by the time I finished writing the book and doing all the reporting and sort of going through the difficulty of this material, in a sense, I did kind of come to some place of accommodation by the end of it, which is why the subtitle of the book is I think pretty apt, a personal journey to the end of the world and back. I did kind of make it back in some form, yeah, or other.
Solipsistic as we are in New Zealand, let us attend first of all to your visit, yeah, here, which is pretty interesting. On a basic level, you came to see the hidey hole that Peter Thiel had bought for himself, because a lot of Silicon Valley billionaires have thought of New Zealand as a very safe place. And he epitomises a lot of your people that you describe in here, in that it's all about him, right?
Yeah, I mean, one of the sort of aspects of how the apocalypse kind of presents itself to us as a myth and as a sort of a fantasy about the future is, you know, it's oftentimes a fantasy of escape, for lots of different kinds of people. And I was very interested in, you know, my first book, To Be a Machine, which is about the transhumanist movement and sort of people in Silicon Valley who are trying to live forever. I'd written a lot about Peter Thiel in that book. And I kind of returned to him again here, almost against my will or against my better judgment, because it seemed to me that his interest in New Zealand was, it had a lot to say about the present, actually, in a way. And I got very fascinated in the sort of ideologies surrounding his apparent interest in New Zealand. And as you say, like the Peter Thiel, the visit to Peter Thiel's, the site of his supposed apocalyptic compound is sort of the simple sort of core of the chapter, but there's a lot of very complicated things surrounding that about New Zealand and about, you know, art and culture and politics and all these things.
Yeah, no, it's quite a dense chapter, and we haven't got time to go into all of it here, but suffice to say that you were able to wave at our Prime Minister.
Yeah, very briefly. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, she has a little cameo in the chapter. Anthony Burt, who I believe has been a guest on your show in the past, and Simon Denny, who are two of the people who I wrote about in the chapter. I was on my way to the South Island in New Zealand to trespass on Peter Thiel's land. And although I believe you have right to roam laws in New Zealand, so I'm not about to be arrested by Interpol. But we passed by Jacinda Ardern in the airport, and Anthony, I think, knew her very slightly from her days as, am I right in saying she was culture shadow minister at one point?
You may well be right, actually. Those were the days before COVID, so our memory is incomplete.
Yeah. Thank you for giving me the benefit of the doubt.
Anthony Burt talked to you about this book, The Sovereign Individual, which is, as he said, the end game for Thiel. And The Sovereign Individual reckons that a new cognitive elite will redesign the world, and this is a belief that's held by a lot of these kind of preppers, and you can class Peter Thiel in with the preppers, which is a pretty, I don't know, what is it? It's a white supremacist thing. That's the theme throughout this book, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's not specifically a book about white supremacism, but it is, you know, racism definitely comes.
Yeah,
for sure. Yeah, racism definitely comes into all of these kind of fantasies around, you know, whether it's, you know, sort of the lower end of the scale, as it were, the doomsday preppers with their, you know, YouTube videos on stockpiling tinned goods and, you know, stockpiling guns and ammo and preparing for, you know, a collapse of civilization and protecting themselves and their families against savagery, whether it's those people or, you know, much higher up the scale, people like Peter Thiel. There is always an element of, I think a kind of a reactionary vision of, in some ways, a return to a kind of fantasied version of the past, where there is a kind of an elite, an elect, as it were, people who are kind of, in some ways, it's a quite sort of masculinist, sort of chauvinist vision, where, you know, you've got a kind of a hyper-prepared, hyper kind of rugged individualist who's going to sort of protect themselves and their family against a collapsed civilization. But it's a very bleak vision of civilization itself. And, you know, where I kind of come to in the book is the people who are most obsessed with, you know, apocalyptic visions and preparing for the end of the world, most of those people don't fully believe in the idea of civilization in the first place. What they believe in is the individual. What they believe in is themselves and, you know, sort of fantasies of wealth and power and individualism. Community doesn't really come into many of these visions. So I wanted to kind of explore the ways in which the idea of the apocalypse, the fantasy of the apocalypse, actually kind of proceeds from, existing ideologies that affect the present.
I mean, it's all very Ayn Rand as well, isn't it? Let's talk about Robert Vicino. Is that how you pronounce his name?
Yes, that's right.
And he's building a post-apocalypse city out of old weapons storage facilities in the Black Hills of South Dakota. And this is what he says. He says there's going to be gangs roaming, cannibals in great numbers, raping and pillaging. Before we talk about what he's offering as an escape, does he think something is going to cause that, or is it just a general apocalypse?
Well, you know, like most kind of people who take a keen interest in the apocalypse, he has his sort of pet theories. He has his sort of preferred scenario, as it were. You know, a lot of that has to do with, you know, say a nuclear strike from North Korea, but you know, it could be anything. He's sort of, you know, the apocalypse is a broad church. So, you know, when I met him, part of our sort of dynamic as writer and subject, in a way, was him approaching me as someone who might buy into his vision. He's, as you kind of mentioned, he's in the process of building what he describes as the world's largest survival community, which is this kind of private compound, almost like a mini state that would be patrolled by a private army. And you would buy into this place and you would be, you know, safe from the marauding hordes of the unprepared people on the outside. And really the sort of nature of our conversation was him trying to sell me this idea. And, you know, he had plenty of different sort of apocalyptic scenarios at his fingertips. Like a lot of great salesmen, he kind of figures out what you're most likely to, what your sort of weak point is. And so whether it's climate change or an asteroid strike or, you know, global nuclear exchange or whatever it is, there's an apocalypse to suit every customer.
Were you tempted to get a bunker?
Well, by the end of it, I mean, I should say, I don't think you'd have me now after the book has come out. I don't think I'd be welcome into the compound. But I think by the end of it, where I landed was, you know, if, you know, I think I would rather be on the outside of a situation like that. I would not want to be among the elect. I would not want to be one of the people who's protected by, you know, a private army and, you know, protected from the sort of the mass of savages on the outside, because it is a very extreme, very bleak kind of hyper-capitalist, hyper-individualist vision of, in some ways, the way the world already is. You know, that's what really interested me about this scenario. It almost presented itself to me as a kind of a very extreme sort of metaphor for certain ways in which the world is already heading towards you know, very radical inequality and you know, having to ignore the plight of like vast growing numbers of people. So it's as much, you know, the book is, as you know, always as much about the present as it is about any kind of possible future.
The Mars Society is looking forward to a life free of tax and government control. So once again, it's a libertarian dream. But it seems so weird that you could imagine that life was going to be nice on Mars. It's got to be some kind of metaphor rather than a real idea, doesn't it?
Well, I mean, people genuinely are, and lots of people, hoping to get to Mars. You know, Elon Musk, Thiel's former PayPal colleague, is one of the most prominent of these, probably the most prominent sort of advocate of creating colonies on Mars. And so there are lots of acolytes, lots of people who, you know, think he can get us there. And I attended a week-long conference in Los Angeles of a group called the Mars Society. Yeah, and heard lots of kind of arguments and counter-arguments and sort of speculative visions of what a colony on Mars might entail. But yeah, as you say, they generally reduce to kind of quite sort of hyper-libertarian, sort of quite utopian views of, you know, setting up a private, often corporate colony on Mars and being free of government control and taxation and, you know, state interference and all these kinds of things. So in a way that links with some of Thiel's more kind of radical and extreme sort of visions around the sovereign individual and indeed New Zealand.
One can't avoid the suspicion that these kind of preppers, the libertarians, are part of a kind of self-fulfilling prophecy, aren't they? In that if you pull out of the world, the world will indeed go to hell.
I think that's true. And one of the things that I try to sort of sort of press on a little bit in the book is the idea that, you know, if you are preparing for the collapse of civilization in this way, if you are convinced that the apocalypse is coming and you're preparing for it in a way that just protects you and your property and your sort of small circle, and, you know, says, you know, let everyone else go to hell because civilization is going to collapse and people will revert to savagery or whatever it is. I think if that's your position, then for you, civilization has already collapsed. And, in, you know, part of what I wanted to do in the book was to, in, not in any kind of polemical way, I don't think, but to advance a sort of a counter argument whereby, you know, community is the thing that will allow us to get through these times of crisis and calamity. And I think one of the strange kind of ironies around the book coming out at the time that it has come out is that, you know, in some ways, a lot of the people who I write about, you know, the preppers and so on, in some ways they've been proven right. I mean, the thing has happened. The catastrophe in some way has come. And particularly early on, I presume it was a little bit more, you know, a little bit less sort of panicked in New Zealand, but certainly here and obviously in the UK, in the early days, just before the lockdown happened, there was a lot of sort of panic buying and, you know, people fighting in the supermarkets over toilet rolls and stuff like that. Or at least there was the perception of those things happening, and they were sort of being, you know, pushed through the media and social media and so on. So there was a moment where it seemed, you know what, maybe the preppers had a point, you know, and you know, they possibly had some cause to feel a little bit smug. And, you know, personally, I had moments in those days where, you know, I bought a lot of, you know, practical guides to prepping for catastrophes and so on when I was writing the book. And I read those books in a spirit of basically sort of ironic distance, in a spirit of kind of scholarly interest. And I found myself taking them down off the shelves and flicking through them and looking at the indexes and, you know, thinking, well, maybe actually there is something to be learned from a practical point of view from these books. But really what has, I think, you know, by and large happened, and what's been proven, is that people are basically decent and they don't revert to savagery in the face of a crisis. That, you know, cannibals aren't roaming on the streets of Dublin, at least not that I'm aware of. And so, you know, I think what has, to the extent that we are getting through this crisis, which is, you know, it's different in various countries, but I think it is a sense of community and a sense of shared purpose and a sense of the common good. And I think that definitely is one sense in which the preppers have been proven wrong.
Yes, I mean, some have found this book hopeful.
yeah.
Partly because those preparing...
Not you.
Well, partly because those preparing for the end of the world, as you've described them, are generally speaking, start raving bonkers, right? So you can think, okay.
Well, yes.
So they're bonkers.
I mean, to some extent. I think they're bonkers in a way that reflects the bonkersness of a lot of our culture, actually. So I think that's what's interesting about it.
Ah, so each Armageddon is reflecting the culture. Because we've always had an Armageddon throughout time, haven't
we? Yes, that's right. Yeah, it's always been the apocalypse. And I think what's interesting, you know, one of the sort of major things that drew me to this topic is the sense that it's the apocalypse has always kind of come into view. It always like appears on the horizon at times of particular upheaval and change, when, you know, change in society seems particularly rapid and the future seems particularly kind of dark and unknowable. I think, times like now, in an obvious sense. And it's always then that the apocalypse presents itself as a kind of, in some ways, a simplifying idea, you know, in a way that is somewhat similar, I think, to many forms of, you know, mythology. And, you know, in some ways, religion, even things like conspiracy theories, all kinds of stories that simplify, you know, narratives that simplify what is, you know, fiendishly complex and at times, you know, impenetrable to understanding. The apocalypse is a way of sort of corralling all these fears and anxieties and complexities into something that is coherent and in a way that, you know, historically and culturally, the apocalypse has always done that. That, in another sense, that was what gave me something to hold on to when I was writing the book. Because as I said at the beginning, the book really arose out of my own kind of inchoate and sort of very various fears, and the apocalypse was a way for me to sort of bring those things together, and it gave it a focus. You know, I could sort of project my own anxieties and confusions out to the outside world, onto people like Peter Thiel and onto these preppers. So, it's true to say that they do come across like nutters, and in some cases they absolutely are. But I think that sort of extremity reflects, in a way that was very sort of seductive and persuasive to me, some of my own darker fears and anxieties. And I think that the sort of fears of society in general.
You've got two epigraphs in the book. One is Greta Thunberg saying in her famous speech, I don't want your hope. I want you to panic. I want you to act as if your house is on fire. And another by Annie Dillard, who's an American writer, and she says, these times of ours are ordinary times, a slice of life like any other. Who can bear to hear this? Or who will consider it? Can you talk to me about that? Because that's a very interesting quote.
I think those two quotes represent for me the sort of poles of the book, that sort of the extremes of the book in a way. Dillard's, Greta Thunberg's sort of almost messianic vision is one extreme, which is that, it's something I hold to be quite true, which is that we are in this time of like very intense, very urgent sort of end time crisis now with climate change. And it's something that we've sort of been a little bit prone to forget about over the last few months with the virus, but it's not going anywhere. You know? And I think that was one thing that I wanted to keep in mind when I was writing the book, is that, there is a very real kind of apocalyptic scenario looming on the horizon. And the other kind of frame, I suppose, is represented by Dillard's view, which is that it's always the end of the world, in a way that sort of reflects what I was just saying about the apocalypse kind of coming into view at times of crisis and upheaval. It's always the end of the world, and yet it's never the end of the world. The apocalypse is an ongoing concern throughout history. It's a sort of a recurring pattern, and it's something that recurs again and again, almost with every generation. And that was something that I wanted to keep in mind while writing the book, that, as urgent and as, strange and unique as our time seems to me, and in some ways is, I wanted to honor that while also keeping in mind the fact that this is always the case. It's always the end of the world.
It's always the end of the world. So, how are you dealing? Are you locked down in Dublin? What is it?
We're kind of tentatively coming out of it now over the last while. We're not, we're nowhere near really where you guys are in New Zealand. We're hoping to get there at some point. But, I think some form of reduced circumstances, normality has kind of returned. There's a feeling of, it's summertime here at the moment, and, the weather is good and people are out and about. And the bars, I think, are going to be opening soon, which everyone is a little bit sort of ambivalent about, a little bit nervous about that. But so far, we're kind of easing out of lockdown, and we're able to travel, and things are kind of opening up a little bit. It's, it's nothing like what it was, and it's nothing as, sort of chaotic as the situation in the UK or certainly in the US. But, we're kind of inching back towards some form of normal everyday life.
Good to know. Thank you for the book. It's a lovely thing, and very good to talk to you. Thank you, Mark O'Connell. Mark O'Connell in Dublin.